Hi, Jordan. My name is Tanya. I'm from Sino-British College, and I take my internship in the International SOS. So I have few questions. Like, I read this piece of newspaper, and it says you went to China in 1999, and you found Chinese people do eat snake. And if I need, it's very amazed you. So my question is, because China is more puts more focus on the globalization, economics globalization. So in what kind of part that make you feel China amaze you? And for example, as I heard that you mentioned a lot of times of criteria. So will China set new criteria in the economics way? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I started in the far south, saw the snakes, and decided I needed to come north. So from then on, it's Shanghai I've come to. It's been my home. It actually reminds me a lot of Toronto. It's a financial center of the country. It's a port city. It's open, exposed to the world. A source of intellectual leadership in the media, in the universities, of culture and the arts. So there's much of Shanghai that I like. Now, there's a couple of things that I don't like in Shanghai or in Toronto sometimes, the traffic jams. And of course, the air quality is not always of the best. I'm lucky because I come here, you know, when they have big summits, right? And the sky's miraculously clear. But if I were living here year-round, I would say, President Xi, please bring that ecological civilization to Shanghai all year round. Oh, and by the way, to Toronto too. So now those are perhaps the inanimate objects, but above all, it's the people. I must say, we Canadians, we really care about languages. It's a bilingual country, and much more than that. The third largest language spoken at home in Canada is Chinese. My daughter-in-law is a Canadian of Chinese origin, so globalization, I think, happened between me in Toronto and you in Shanghai long before perhaps the G20 sprung to life. So the linguistic diversity here, I'm still struggling with a few words in standard Chinese. But I'd love to learn Shanghaiese soon. I hope you're from Shanghai, but okay.
好，我们有请下一位，我们请中排的这位男士。
Thank you. My name is Li Xing, and I graduate from Shanghai Institute for International Studies. Well, first, I want to thank you, Mr. Curtin, for your work, and of course, and the work of your group to contribute for the G20 Center. I mean, when I was a student, I gained a lot of help and information from the website you established. Well, my question focused on financial issues. Well, one great function of the G20 now is to manage financial risk in order to prevent financial crisis. How can the consensus, well, the leaders reached in the summit, can be transformed into real actions? Then, well, the individual individual enterprise and financial institutions can, be used in their daily operations. Well, the question can be further extended to, well, in post-crisis time. Without such imminent crisis, well, without such imminent financial crisis, to be exactly, how the role of G20 will change? Oh, that's my question. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me start, and Jay Jin may have some thoughts on it. You're right. Agreements reached at the summit peak have to be brought back when our leaders descend into the dark valleys of domestic politics at home and implement. But what we've seen is that one of the areas of G20 governance where compliance has been the highest is precisely the one that you identified, domestic financial regulation and supervision. That's in part because you do have the strongest ministerial meeting by far working for 10 years before the leaders, finance ministers, and they're supported by finance deputies and those below. So when they make agreements with their colleagues, and it's a pretty specialized club, folks from finance ministries often become more loyal to their fellows from finance ministries of foreign countries than they do in other ministries at home. They speak a common language, think a common way. But back home, often those finance ministries, and the same can be said for central bankers, they're the ones who have the authority to do domestic financial regulation at home. That's overwhelmingly true in countries like Canada, and we had no banks go bust during the financial crisis. It's less so in the United States, where you have about 30 different agencies regulating it, but on the whole it's true. And it has remained true long after the initial American-turned-global financial crisis was solved, long after the crisis prevention phase. So even when the G20 has moved to global steering, 2013 onwards, financial regulatory and supervisory agreements made at the G20 leaders' levels do tend to be implemented back home. So you don't need a crisis. You don't even need a recent crisis. There is a common bond. One other element, I think, of the success of financial regulation is what you might call the G20 secretariat or the G20 semi-secretariat. And it's a debate, shouldn't it create a secretariat? It already has one. Remember, I started with identifying the two distinctive core missions of this international institution, the G20. The first, to promote financial stability. The second, to make globalization work for the benefit of all. But on financial stability, if we go back to 1999, as Jay Jin and I had discussed, from G7 to G20, one of the things that the G7 created to cope with the Asian-turned-global financial crisis was not just the G20, but there were two other international institutions. One was the International Monetary and Finance Committee of the IMF. Gordon Brown was the key figure there, Treasury Secretary of the United Kingdom. The third was something called the Financial Stability Forum. And who was a member? Well, the G7 and a few more countries, polities. Hong Kong was one. It was a financial center. It was in Asia, but not China, not the People's Republic of China. Flash forward to 2009, there's a G20 summit, the bigger American-turned global financial crisis. And one of the historic decisions of the London summit was to create the Financial Stability Board with all G20 members, including China, as full equal members. And it, headquartered over in Switzerland, works day in, day out to help create advice to the G20 leaders about what the next steps are to stay one step ahead of shadow banking. In China, is that a problem? What do we do about that? The risk from climate change to insurance companies and banks and much of the financial system, they're doing that now. The current head of the Financial Stability Board is Mark Carney. He's the governor of the Central Bank of the United Kingdom, of the Bank of England. Before that, he was the governor of the Bank of Canada. He's a Canadian, so he's done his own globalization, I guess, but is from Canada to Britain, but is now serving the G20 as a whole through the Financial Stability Board. So institutions, permanent institutions, do matter. The thought experiment is, if you think the G20 needs another secretariat for its second mission, making globalization work for the benefit of all, how should one approach designing that? Jay Jin, did you have some thoughts or questions?
Okay. 这个确实呢，我也同意刚才柯顿教授讲的，就是说如果我们去看呢，就是G20呢在这种危机之后，它怎么样的呢保持它的有效性，就是特别是呢这个做出来的承诺呢，怎么样的去落实。其实呢，如果做一个比较，在G20的这个治理当中啊，就是会看得比较明显。G20呢最近几年呢，大家。一直也是在批评说，这个落实承诺不好的领域，比如说贸易，就是呢，每次呢都说呢要这个抵制贸易保护主义，但是呢，如果你去看数据的话呢，就是这个领导人峰会之后，那么这个很长一段时间，你看这个世界上的贸易保护主义措施呢，很多都是来自于G20国家，所以呢，这个很多人就在说，就是为什么贸易会出现这种情况？但是如果你看其他的这个问题领域，就是领导人做了承诺，那么落实的比较好的，一个呢就是刚才柯顿教授提到的这个金融的监管，就是因为在这个G20的这个它只是一个论坛，那么在这个论坛的下面，它有没有一个其他的这种国际组织在支撑它的工作？这个柯顿教授提到了那个，就是这个金融监管领域，它就有金融稳定理事会，就是本来呢在这个G7的框架下，它是一个金融稳定论坛，它是G7的成员国占主导的，但是呢在G20当中呢，这个伦敦峰会呢把金融稳定论坛升级成了这个金融稳定理事会，基本上所有的G20国家呢，这个都是在这个当中平等的成员国。那么这样的话，它有了一个实体的机构做支撑的话，那么领导人的承诺在会议的，论坛当中的承诺，它就有了一个呢，就是我们中国人讲的就有腿了，就是它有这么一个机构去支撑它的这个承诺落实。那么呢，这个呢，大家看到，其实我们今年呢，中国呢，其实也是在这方面做的呢比较好。就是七月份的这个 G20 的这个成都财长会之前呢，这个李克强总理呢开了那个一加六的这个圆桌对话，就是中国把 G20 涉及到的六个国际经济组织 ，IMF 世界银行、这个 WTO、OECD， 这个金融稳定理事会、国际劳工组织六个国际组织的领导人来北京呢跟。克强总理对话，其实呢，议题呢跟 G20 这个当中的议题有很多是重合的，但是呢，中国就是强调，就是在后危机时代 ，G20 的运作，它还是呢要跟这些就是这种呢这个原来的国际组织之间呢保持一个良好的互动，这样的话呢，这个有利于它的承诺落实。这个呢，其实在这个 G20 的未来的这个运行当中啊，这一点其实非常重要的一点。
好的，感谢两位。我们请中间这位男士。
好，我是来自上海应用自由大学的教师，我叫李建明。请允许我用中文提问。请问柯东教授，我呢非常对那个中国的对外关系非常感兴趣， 因为我平时所看到的所听到的比较多的是中国的声音，我非常想知道西方世界是如何看待中国的，看待现在的中国，比如说西方的学术界、西方的政要，比如对中国现在的对外政策，认为我们是强势的多一点，还是认为我们是谦和的多一点？比如说对中国的领导力，对世界的领导力，是希望提升这种领导力的多一些，还是希望遏制这种领导力的多一些？谢谢。
Well, thank you for the question. I can speak for myself, if I can speak for my fellow Canadians and those elsewhere in the world, and it depends which outsiders you're thinking of. The Canadian people as a whole, we know from public opinion surveys, treat China with ambivalence. And the usual dichotomy is that yes, it's a great power, yes, we need to trade more with it. Canada's an export-dependent economy like China. But on the other hand, we worry about human rights and a broad range of human rights, labor rights, labor union rights, religious rights. So the trade versus human rights trade-off is ones that Canadians, on the whole, don't think China has solved domestically, and that leads to the ambivalence about it. And it has a very practical effect, which Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will face when he lands. Should Canada join the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank? Should Canada begin the process of moving towards the possibility of a bilateral free trade agreement with China, especially as it looks like Canada's number one choice, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is not moving ahead quickly. But beyond that understandable and indeed appropriate ambivalence, I think Canadians are aware that there are more important issues than either trade and, yes, human rights. One is climate change. It is one of our Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's priority issues for the Hangzhou summit. And if you worry about climate change, you think of integrated ecosystems of all living things, not just human beings, and their individual rights. You think about collective responsibilities. And China is doing so much now to move towards controlling climate change. I mentioned coal. So much else that Canadians who care about controlling climate change first, and many do, look at China as a leader and an admirable one in ways that they know that they will certainly not get if Donald Trump becomes the president of the United States. And when Canadians think of oceans, they think of, and we've got lots of oceans. Canada is a country with the largest coastline in the world. We are number one. We border on the three great oceans of the world, the Pacific, the Atlantic, and the Arctic, which is getting warmer. It's opening. The ice is melting. So we've suffered from overfishing, as have the fishers of China. We worry about living things in the oceans, as do our Australian colleagues. The Great Barrier Reef, the coral reefs, are dying. So when we think of the world's seas, the ones around Canada, those east of Japan, east of China, in the South China Sea, that's what we think of first. And we know that the G20 has actually governed other world oceans before, at Russian initiative a few summits ago, a move to identify marine protected areas in the wake of the great disaster from oil drilling rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. So if you put the environment first, you look favorably on China and look to the potential of China's G20 to do those bigger or bolder things not yet on the agenda for it. One could look at other issues. One could speak of nuclear weapons, the prospect of, through accidents, nuclear war returning to the world. Nuclear weapons have been used twice before. And relative to other major powers, the P5 powers, China, from everything we know, is a highly responsible nuclear power. The last of the second last of the big five to actually get a bomb of its own. So when you look at President Obama's nuclear safety summit and see China's behavior there, one on the whole sees responsibility again. So it's not just that we know we need China. In the China we see, when we take a closer look, we see a responsible, a respectable China, rather than a threatening one, which is why I think that mass of Canadians who answer the questions on the mass public opinion polls with that deep ambivalence should learn more about China. We can do that two ways, sending more of them here and sending more Chinese there. What we do when we're back in Toronto is try and help with the second half, and Jay Jin lend a hand by coming with us a few years ago. Jay Jin, what does the rest of the world think of, or the rest of Toronto think of China?
这个呢，因为我是2008年在多伦多大学访学，当时呢就是也跟很多这个加拿大人的这个接触，我感觉呢，其实呢这个对中国啊，就是说因为呢西方人当然就是说确实呢他们的媒体就是我觉得是有一些这种一些偏见，但是呢如果是真的跟中国人打交道。他会觉得呢，其实呢，这个今天的中国啊，就是已经呢，这个就是完全不是像他们这种一些媒体呢，就是说是个刻画的那样。所以我觉得呢，对我们来说呢，其实呢，如果从这个回到那个问题，就是说西方人到底怎么看看中国，包括中国在国际舞台上发挥领导力，这个更多的情况呢。其实我觉得就像在 G20 当中一样的，就是中国更多的是通过这种在金融危机，包括在这种世界经济，就是说让西方人感受到，就是呢，这个中国的这种负责任的行为，就中国的这个行为啊，它已经呢就是完全呢就是不是西方的这种一些那种，特别是这种媒体的那种偏见。
好，谢谢两位。我们请后区的这位男士。
Thank you, Mr. Curtin, for your impressive speech today. I'm a current student of Shanghai Institute for International Studies. And my focus area is Southeast Asia politics and its development. We know that China invited Thailand, Laos, and Singapore as guest country to the Hangzhou summit. And how would you say those countries be invited into the Hangzhou summit, and what kind of role you think they could play in the Hangzhou summit, and will they continually play such kind of role in the future G20 summit? Thank you.
We'll have to see, because in the G20, increasingly, there's stronger prerogatives of the host, and Angela Merkel, the host at Hamburg next year, has not signaled her approach to what can be called outreach. Laos, some of the others that you mentioned. Now, some suspicious Canadians might say, aha, China is just rounding up its small dependent friends that support it on a number of issues, including along the new Silk Road. So it looks like China has basically used the G20 to govern for itself and its own project. But if you want to take seriously one of the priorities, it's called industrialization of Africa, and the least developed countries, the latter was central at the Turkish summit last year, the LLDCs. And since we're in Asia now, Turkey privileged Africa, why not have a stronger Asian voice from the poorest countries of the world? And that certainly includes Laos, for example. Why not use the Silk Road to bring sustainable development to Laos and some of the other countries? China has invited more country leaders as guests than any other host before. So to go back to an earlier question of going beyond, as it were, the 66% population or the 20 versus the G172, the other members of the UN that are left out, right, to China, is really doing that kind of inclusiveness more than ever before. But there's only so much time at a summit, so how many minutes will the leader of Laos get to speak, and how many will listen when he does? These are the practical questions. Involvement is one thing, influence is another. And if the leaders know he's not going to be back there next year, well, you know, you cannot pay particular attention to him for the longer and medium-term issues that the Hangzhou summit is, under Chinese leadership, focusing on. So I think we need to find a better way to do outreach, even still giving the hosts their some flexibility to put their own imprint on it. My instinct is, even though Canada has its favorites in the world, and our Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has named two of them, our global families are the Commonwealth and La Francophonie, those two summit-level international institutions together represent about half the countries in the world, 50 and 50. And we don't have very many Francophone countries in the G20 as members or as guests. But I think the way to move beyond that is to actually include the G193, that's the United Nations, right? In a more systematic way. So my thinking has now turned to the reform of the G20 governance to connect it more closely to the UN and the UN galaxy as a whole.
好，谢谢国际研究院。我们还有一个讨论会，大家通过上海国际问题研究院的微信公众号，可以继续去上海国际问题研究院再跟柯顿教授讨论。那一天还有另外一本新书，就是《龙之足迹》，是加拿大 CG 研究所的，所以欢迎大家继续参与。在做最后的评论之前呢，我想首先我想要感谢一下这个文汇讲堂，这是上海国际问题研究院和文汇讲堂首度合作，就 G20 呢组织的这样的一个专家讲座。可能有部分的这个听众呢参加了第一场讲座，就是由我们陈同晓院长和黄仁伟院长共同主讲的，张宇院所长呢因为有事儿没来。今天是第二场，我们请了加拿大的这个著名 G20 专家 John Curtin 教授来这里给大家做一个介绍，正好反映了中国学者和这个外国学者不同的这样的一个视角。 在这里呢，我想请大家和我一起要特别的感谢为了这个讲堂做出默默无闻巨大贡献和努力的理念，因为我跟他合作，我知道他做了多少非常细致的这个工作，也要感谢我们陈书记陈振平书记，因为他的鼎力支持也是给我们学者，就是给我们智库和公众之间架构了这样的一个桥梁，使得我们的研究能够走进大家的这个视野，所以这一个讲座呢是非常有意义的，我想请大家对我们的理念还有我们的陈书记表示感谢。我的总结呢说不上总结，因为这个洁净教授和这个 John Curtin 教授呢用了这个两个多小时的时间，实际上非常全面地向大家解释了 G20 从何而来，从这个1975年七国集团建立，到1999年二十国集团财长和央行行长峰会建立，到2008年这个峰会建立，给我们系统地介绍了 G20 走到今天的这样的一个过程。那么第二点呢，他们也通过他们的这个对话讨论还有 John Curtin 的这个回答的问题，向我们解释了 G20 平台为什么重要，因为有很多的这个舆论是针对这个 G20 跟我们有什么关系啊，带来了这么多交通的管制，带来了生活的不便，还有听众提到了我们要花这么多的钱承担这么多的责任，但是他们的这个对话和讲座呢实际上解释了 G20 为什么重要。我想呢总结一下他们的这个观点，我想有三个方面来说明 G20 为什么重要。第一个，它是真正意义上的系统性重要国家都参与其中的平等对话论坛，由1975年的七国集团由发达国家完全主导的这种话语演变到今天有这个主要新兴经济体参加的这样的一个对话平台不容易，弹指一挥间40多年过去了，中国才能平等地坐到这个桌子上跟这个西方大国共商全球经济治理里面的重要议题，所以说走到今天这一步是不容易。而且大家也注意到，即使到今天在二十国集团里面还有斗争，金砖有对话，非正式的对话，二十国集团七国集团还有对话，今年日本作为 G7 的主席国，中国作为 G20 主席国，明争暗斗是有的，这个暗中较劲也是有的，所以走到今天非常不容易。而且这一次峰会是中国建国以来历史上第一次级别最高涵盖地区最宽泛的一次对话，以前我们那个经合组织对话 APEC 亚就是亚太地区，我们中非合作论坛中非和中国和拉美，这是真正意义上的一个多边外交最高级别的。所以它为什么重要，我想今天这个讲座呢非常好的诠释了这一点。第二点呢，我想大家知道全球经济治理为什么难，因为达成政治共识非常的难。那么就是以前是七国集团，大家批评它缺乏代表性，富人俱乐部，变成二十国集团了还是批评为什么我没被包括之内，为什么这些国家老挝邀请了他，即使作为这个东盟的这个主席国轮值主席国邀请了，那我也想坐在这个桌子跟前。所以大家看到除非他变成联合国，否则永远面临合法性的这个质疑。但是 G20 为什么有效，因为二十个成员方相对成员较少，比较容易达成共识。但是又一个问题产生了，就像大家问这个朱教授和这 Curtin 教授的问题一样， G20 没有落实机制啊，你谈了等于空谈，所以大家对他又有质疑。但是正如 Curtin 教授所指出的那样， G20 在非常纷繁复杂的全球经济治理难题之前难题和这个具体的每个国家的这个政策落实之间架立了一个桥梁，就是从全球共识到国别政策的那个落实，以及邀请主要的全球经济治理组织参与这样的一个对话，这个平台的重要性对达成国际共识的贡献是不可取代的。所以我想这个第二点是非常重要的。第三点呢，它对世界经济的长远的一个影响，这也就是 Curtin 教授里面他在他的讲座里面特地提到了这个 G20 机制从危机应对到危机预防再到这个全球经济治理的这样的一个掌舵的这样的一个机构，所以它是非常重要的。提问大家中间也提到了2030可持续发展议程，这个关乎全人类的一个发展目标，也是中国今年作为主席国着力推进的一份集体行动计划。所以说可以看到这个平台对于规划我们人类社会共同的一个未来
这个平台的存续也具有它长远和深远的影响意义。我想这三点至少是从今天的讲座里面我们可以学习到的，就是 G20 平台为什么重要。那么作为我个人呢，我想利用这个总结的机会呢，我也想通过就是这样一个平台对大家的一个问题，包括就是 G20 到底对我们有什么关系。因为我也看到一些抱怨，我想至少有两点有关。第一点，中国的声音，中国的利益谁来听，人家发达国家愿不愿意听。所以今天一个非常好的一个提问呢，就是关于都是西方的这个价值观或者话语主导，到今天开始有中国的声音被听。其中我们的问题涉及到地区地缘的这个政治冲突的问题，比如南海的问题，也涉及到新成立的中国新开发银行，包括 AIB 的这样的一个问题，也涉及到一带一路。这些问题怎么样能够，或者这些新的机构，中国新的倡议怎么能被西方国家所接受呢？大家知道亚洲基础设施投资银行成立的时候，美国人是反对的，不参加的，英国人参加了之后被视为一种背叛。所以大家可以看到中国怎么样才能让这些发达国家相信中国不是一个挑战者，不是一个消极的对抗者。所以我想科顿教授做了非常好的诠释，中国从一个西方眼中的对抗者变成一个合作者，变成一个合作伙伴。我们要让别人接纳和认同中国多么难。所以中国走到今天主办 G20 的峰会，我想这是真正意义上中国实现了让世界倾听中国的声音，然后中国拿出中国对全球经济治理难题的中国方案。所以我想这一点是跟我们每个人国家命运对我们每个人都是有影响的，我想这是第一点重要的。那么对我们个人有什么何干呢？我想这个其实上对我们每个人都有关系。大家还记得2011年上海开世博会的时候也有很多的这个不便，但是经过世博会以后，上海城市的服务水平和这个承载能力我想是一个实质性的提升。杭州峰会也进行了交通管制，从北京一直延续到这个京沪线，一直到延续到杭州城，大家感觉到了很多不便，但是这是非常必要的压力测试。就是我们应对这样大的一个峰会，这样大的一个系统性的组织的时候，会暴露我们非常多的不完善的地方。民众的抱怨就是压力，这个压力就是促使我们的政府提供更好的公共服务的一个机会。所以我想所有的不便也是会被政府所关注和倾听的，我想这是一个好事情，并不是一个坏事情。因为我们的国家在发展，城市在发展，但是我想与此跟上的是我们每个公民每个市民的觉醒意识也要跟着发展。所以也非常感谢支持这个文汇讲堂也来参与能够听学者讲一讲的这所有的今天的这个观众。然后最后呢，林店给我布置个任务，让我评这个最佳提问者。其实这很难，因为我觉得每个人的提问都非常有代表性，都非常的好。总共有8个问题，科顿教授还没有来得及回答后面的这样的4个问题。那我想就他前面回答的问题以及就是后面没有回答的问题，我想把这个礼物呢最好分成两份，分给两个人，让大家都有参与。那么从专业的角度来看的话，我想可能最具专业性的，我想给上海国际研究院已经毕业的学生李欣，他现在在上海清算所工作。他提问的一个问题呢，其实切中了今天这个 Cotton 教授讲座就是 G20 的两大使命之一，金融稳定。所以他从金融稳定的角度，我想提的这个问题是非常有专业性。而且我奖励给他是因为我也希望像他这样已经毕业了的学生还能够继续关注中国的外交、中国的这个经济和中国参与全球经济治理。
今天的互动内容呢将在明天的文汇讲堂微信上面刊发，演讲的音频经过整理之后3天之后也会上线喜马拉雅的文汇微电台，1周之内会在文汇报上面整版的刊登。也预祝 G20 峰会顺利召开，预祝科顿教授的监督问责报告越来越有效。那第104期呢，我们将聚焦历史学家汤英迪，希望我们可以不见不散。